Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. Okay, Baruch Hashem. Did the bird be reed? Yeah, she be reed? No. Okay, I guess that didn't go over well. The last time I gave a shir in Hebrew was I was in Israel a few years ago, and my wife's cousins like shul. So they, even though everybody there speaks English, so I gave a shir after davening in English, that they allowed, but the morning shir has to be in Hebrew. So it was good. It was good practice to finally, you know, give a shir in Hebrew. Anyways, Yiddish, I can't even try. Okay, I won't even start. All right, I think what we'll do today, I hope we'll continue, but we'll try to get into the Megillah itself, some of the stories in the Megillah. We've been doing sort of a little bit of an overview, why Purim's a holiday, and where's God, and who's Achashverosh, and Haman, and etc. All the comparisons to all the other books. So why don't we pick up in the point of Esther. So I think we ended off last week explaining that Achashverosh, it makes no sense to have a queen who you don't know where she comes from. Like, Esther doesn't say where she's from. Now, we don't know why that. I mean, Mordechai tells Esther not to say where she's from, her background. Why does he do that? So she will be picked or she won't be picked as the queen. In other words, do they want Esther as the queen or they don't want Esther as the queen? Achashverosh has a beauty pageant to decide who the next queen is going to be. We spoke last week how the sexual connotation, he wanted Vashti to come basically naked and he wanted to prove he's the king. So they say, why don't we have a beauty contest? We'll gather all the beautiful women, whatever, in Shushan and all 127 like provinces. So presumably, would they want Esther to be part of the contest? Presumably, no. No, right? I would assume not, right? Now, what's the better chance? If you don't want Esther to be the queen, what's the best advice to give her? What should she say? What are the chances are that the Persian king is going to pick a Jewish woman? Zilcho. So you would think they would say, Mordechai would say, tell them you're Jewish. Can you tell them you're Jewish? You won't be picked as the queen, right? I mean, unless somehow, but that would seem to be the logical approach that, because the Megillah doesn't tell us, just don't say who you are. Now, again, in rabbinic tradition, this is part of everything in the Megillah is hidden. Everything God is hidden. We don't really know what's going on. We don't know when the Megillah is taking place. But in the story itself, it doesn't really make any sense that why they would say not to say who she was. Unless they wanted to hide the fact that she is Jewish, because maybe they didn't want to be the king, because maybe they just, it's good to have somebody in political power. We know, because Mordechai is Yoshe Bashar HaMelech. Mordechai hangs out in the gateway of the palace. He's obviously a person of power. We don't know that. I mean, we don't know what he does, but Mordechai has access to at least the outer domain of the kingship. So I just want to point out, the Megillah is really not clear about why it's hidden. We mentioned for Achashverosh, it's cool to have somebody who you don't know who it is, because this gives him more power over the queen. But okay, anyway. So, if you want for sure Esther not to be chosen as the queen, that was my question. The Megillah doesn't tell us if he wants to. So whenever the Torah, or the Tanakh, when they don't tell us, you know what? This is just a general rule. Whenever like there's a debate between the commentaries, so it's usually because the verses are unclear. So they're unclear for a purpose. In other words, we want you to give two explanations that are opposite, because we've mentioned from the first class, nothing in Tanakh is about historical events. They're all about current events. So sometimes the interpretation A makes sense, and sometimes in turn B. I'll give you one of the classic examples that Nechama Leibowitz, you know, has had the pleasure of learning when Nechama Leibowitz, for you, everybody knows who Nechama Leibowitz was? The greatest scholar, I would say, the greatest teacher of Tanakh in the 20th century. She was born in Riga in 1905, came to Israel in the 1930s, and she developed basically all the top teachers of Tanakh today are her students. She had, Gil Yonot had source sheets on the Parsha that she would write every week, and 1,000 people would write to her. You know, she would have questions. She never published the answers on purpose. She refused. She wanted people to think, whatever. And she was really an amazing woman, a great pedagogue in addition to everything else. And she got her PhD in University of Berlin. She was in University of Berlin at the same time Rebbe Soloveitchik was there. And she was a deep Zionist. She could never understand why we would be living outside of Israel. We were basically a bunch of smicha students at Yeshiva University, doing a year of our rabbinic training in Israel, and she taught us for the year, and she couldn't understand. She said, I don't understand. The non-Jew hate us, whatever. And once she made Aliyah in the 30s, she only left Israel once in her life to visit her parents, and she told us she'd offer thousands of dollars to come teach in America, to come for the summer, teach. And it would bother her that people would think she would actually leave Israel just for money. I mean, that would bother her. Her apartment, which I was in once, was smaller than this room, totally full of books. Anyway, she was an amazing woman. So, just to know that, so it's worthwhile for this. So I remember she told us when Adam and Eve sin in the Garden of Eden, when Cain kills Hevel. So God says, where's your brother? So what does Cain say? So he says, Hashomer achi anochi. And then he says, Gadol avoni mean so. Now what does Gadol avoni mean so mean? So my sin is too great to bear. Or it might mean, is my sin too great to bear? Gadol avoni mean so? Is my sin so great? What's the big deal? Or my sin is so great? And that's a debate between Rashi and the Ramban. It's a fundamental debate. It totally changes the whole story. Did Cain accept responsibility? My sin is so great to bear. I did this awful thing. I murdered. I just wiped out half of humanity or whatever. I mean, how could that be? And that's from here we learn, if whoever saves one life is if they save the entire world, and you kill one person, you kill the entire world. I can never gain forgiveness. Or is he like, he joked it off. What's the big deal? Here today, who cares? Another body. So that changes the world. Who's right? In other words, why is the Torah unclear? Because the Torah likes to be unclear, because the Torah wants both messages to get across. What actually happened? I don't know, and I don't care. And it doesn't matter, because the Torah is not talking about Cain and Hevel. The Torah is talking about humanity, why people murder. So that's why, for example, Rashi says they got into a fight, and Rashi says, if you want to know what the fight is, look in the Midrashim, they tell you. But he doesn't tell you the reasons why they fight, because the Midrashim are not concerned why they fought. The Midrashim are fighting. Why did people fight? Anyways, that's just an aside. So the Megillah here doesn't tell us, and that's true in every verse in the Megillah almost. We don't know, and you can interpret it in more than one way. I just want to point out a couple.
Could I comment on?
Absolutely.
So what you were saying was, we don't know, did Mordecai want her to be clean? Or, because if not, then he could have counseled her otherwise. When I've historically read this, my assumption was completely different and more parallel to the story that we drew week one with Sarai, who hid her identity for safety reasons. My assumption was always that once she was requested to appear, it was in her best interest to play the game rather than to reveal that she was actually not qualified, and then that's not necessarily a return home and carry on as you were, but there could be consequences for her being brought into this potential harem
because she is Jewish.
That if she revealed she was Jewish, that would change her status there, perhaps in a harmful way, as opposed to, oh, you're Jewish, well, just go back home. That she was counseled not to reveal.
Because at that point, it was already too late.
Because it was by then already too late.
Could be.
That's how I had always read.
Could be when she's taken. Yeah, okay. Now, what's the point of the Megillah telling us all this? Why does the Megillah tell us this whole story, how he gathered all the women and they sat for 12 months in perfume before they went to, be with the Hashir. So that's what Megillah says. So it's really to show the Megillah is basically denigrating. I mean, Achashverosh totally denigrates women. I mean, if you want to talk in the Me Too generation, whatever, talk about now, women's rights. I mean, the whole Megillah is about putting down women. Now, and we've discussed a few times already the connection to Yosef's story. Vayik Betsua Kol Nara, V'Nara, that's in verse 3, in chapter 2, verse 3. What does Vayik Betsua Kol Nara mean? He gathered every woman. Where does it explain Vayik Betsu come? It's Vayik Betsu comes by Yosef. he gathered all the food. In other words, to Ahasuerus, the women were just like food. They were just like a commodity. You know, eat, throw out. It's that, and that's how the Megillah presents it. They only came and you never came back again. You know, yeah. So it's really, it's in a sense pointing out the sense, and that's why, if, in a certain sense, that's what Esther's all about. In other words, Megillat Esther could have been called Megillat Mordechai. In other words, the question is, who's the hero of the story? Is it more, I mean, again, it's not either or necessarily, but we always think of Esther. But in many ways, it's Mordechai, of course, is the hero of the story. I mean, it's Mordechai who gets Esther into the kingship. Maybe he did want her. I mean, it's queen. You know, maybe he did want her there. It's Mordechai who has to convince her to go. I mean, Esther on her own was not going to save the Jewish people. In other words, the first half of the Megillah, it's all about Mordechai. The second half of the Megillah is all about Esther. And then it says, "Vatichtov Esther Amalka, Esther Mordechai." In other words, they sort of, you know, but it's interesting. But we know the Megillah is Megillat Esther. And this, of course, is a general theme that the rabbis say by every holiday. That, I mean, I want to. I don't mean this as apologetics. I mean that the rabbis really say that it's because of the righteous woman. The story of Hanukkah happened, and the story and Pesach happened because of Miriam, and that's why a woman is obligated to read the Megillah. Even though women are generally exempt from time-bound positive mitzvot, a woman has to eat matzah, and a woman has to hear the Megillah, and a woman has to light Hanukkah candles because the women were involved in all these miracles. Anyways, that's just sort of an interesting aside. Okay. Let's pick up with the plot to kill Ahasuerus. This is verse 21, chapter 2, verse 20. Bayamim ahem, u'Mordechai yoshev b'shar ha'melech. Mordechai is sitting, chapter 2, verse 21. Mordechai is sitting at the gateway of the king. Katzav bigdan b'teirush. Shnei sarisei ha'melech. Same language by Yosef. Saris ha'melech. Potiphar was the saris ha'melech. Matter of fact, teirush means Tirosh, which is wine, is the butler. You know, the butler and the baker. So, and then it's two people plotting to kill the king, you know, like the butler and the baker in Egypt. It's the same story over here. And Mordechai over here is, and the same way, what happened? Yosef saves the butler. And what happens? What does the butler do? He forgets Yosef. Why does he forget Yosef? Remember the story, right? Yosef interprets and says, do me one favor. You're going to get out in 3 days. Remember me. I don't belong in jail. I was framed. I was put here. Please tell Paro to get me out of jail. What are the chances are he's going to do that? Zero. Why are the chances zero? Because he has nothing to gain by Yosef's his competition. What does he need Yosef around for? You know, so why does he finally tell the king about Yosef? Because now the king Paro can't sleep. So he says, I'll find a solution. So I'll get appointed as the viceroy. Of course, he didn't know Yosef, and we never hear from him again. We never hear from the butler again. Yosef was funny. It's politics. It's kulo sheker, you know. They want to kill Mordechai. Okay, so Mordechai tells Esther, and this is, of course, the same way Mordechai is forgotten about for a long time. And it's only later on, when the king can't sleep, that he reads about the story, and that's how the whole story turns. Now, what should happen next? I just laid it out. I skipped over. Achar hadvarim ha'ela. So what is the term achar hadvarim ha'ela? I mean, you'll notice, I don't know if you have it in yours. You see a little like break? You see a pause? Okay, so you know, that's the way you were supposed to read the Chumash. You know, how many parshiyot are there in the Chumash? So it depends what you mean by that term. So the way we read every Simchas Torah, like the weeks, so there are 54 parshiyot. Of course, there are less than 54 weeks in a year, so we have to double up. In a leap year like this year, there are more than 54 weeks in a year, so we have to space them out. But we get lucky, you know, holiday falls on Shabbos, so we don't read the regular laning. That's why all the parshiyot this year are single parshiyot, because it's leap year. Now, you know, of course, that's not the original reading. There used to be a three-year cycle. Of course, the whole reading of the Torah is just the rabbinic mitzvah. It's the most important rabbinic mitzvah the rabbis ever made. I believe that. Had the rabbis not commanded us to read the Torah every week, the Torah would be a closed book. How do I know the Torah would be a closed book? Because when's the last time somebody looked at Sefer Yoshua or Treyasar? The only book anybody knows in Treyasar is Yonah. because we read that on Yom Kippur. The books we don't read in shul, nobody ever looks at. I don't know nobody, but nobody. Right, right. So we know those Haftorah. The Haftorahs were instituted when we couldn't read the Torah. But leave all that aside. It used to be a three-year cycle. The rabbis instituted the reading of Torah so people would learn. People would learn the Torah, and that's what we do. We revolve our life around the Parsha of Shavuot. But if you open up a Chumash, what Parsha means, every once in a while, and if you write a Sefer Torah missing the blank spaces, the Sefer Torah is invalid. Every once in a while, there are blank spaces. We have what we call a Parsha Petucha and Stuma. If it's Petucha, means it's open till the end of the line. And if Stuma, means it's nine empty, like a space for nine letters in the middle of the line. And one of those, and it's there in the Chumash. You read the Chumash, and when they print the Art Scroll, the Chumash, whatever, you see them in the Chumash. Just read. Now sometimes there are every two verses, and sometimes they're 55 verses apart. There's no, it's not any systematic lengthwise, but Rashi tells us that is to those breaks, every break represents a unit, and when you finish a unit, you should go over the unit and think about what's the meaning of the unit. Nobody does this. Nobody learns Chumash like this. But this is the way to learn Chumash. In other words, you open up Bereishit, so you'll see each one of the days of creation gets its own parsha. That makes sense. And you can see sometimes what does the Torah consider one story or two stories. Does the Torah, where does the Torah put its breaks already tells you, and it's a chance to sort of, we have where to pause now, and let's think where we're up to now. So I just pointed out, because right here, between the appointment of, between Mordechai saving the life, you have it right after Esther's appointed. Then you have this middle story with the pause at the beginning and the end about Bigdan and Teresh, right? You see the blank before verse 21. You have a three-verse story, and then another break. This is like a self-contained unit, totally separate from the rest of the story, that later on comes back in the story. But now there's a pause. The Mordechai saves Achashverosh's life. There's a plot to kill him. Achar hadvarim ela. Now we have to think about, okay, what should happen next? So what happens next? What happens next? All the kids know. We meet Haman. We meet Haman. Why do we meet Haman? Why, in other words, why does Achashverosh appoint Haman as the viceroy, whatever term you want to use? Probably, as he was probably chief of security, of Homeland Security. In other words, the Megillah just told us that there was a plot to kill Achashverosh. And the next thing we do, Achashverosh appoints Haman, and he wants everybody is subservient to Haman. He's his, the security chief. Now, who should have been the chief of security? Mordechai. That might explain why Mordechai doesn't want to. What's he appointing Haman, right? Just like in the flow of the story. We don't know anything. We don't know who this Haman guy is. We never heard of him. We mentioned last week the rabbis associate Haman and Mimuchan. Like one person sinned against the queen, the king. You got to make all that about everybody, about all the men have to be the heads of the household. One Jew won't bow down. We have to kill all the Jews. It's the same story. But we don't know anything about Haman. Okay, b'chol avdei ha-melech, asher b'shar ha-melech, k'rim yishachavim la-haman, right? Everybody in the gate has to bow down. Ki chein tziva lo ha-melech. Mordechai lo yichrav, lo yishtachavim. Mordechai won't bow down. Good or bad? Should Mordechai have bowed down?
Well, he should have, if that was the norm for him being...
Right, is there anything... Why doesn't Mordechai bow down? Was Mordechai wrong for not bowing down? Ever think of the question?
Well, if your premise about Mordechai potentially being the one who should be the security person, then he thought he may have been superior to Haman.
Right.
And ultimately not.
But he basically put the Jewish people at risk. And there are people who call him out on this. Well, everybody bows down in the Bible. You meet a king, you bow down. So there is a rabbinic tradition. Again, I sort of throw in these rabbinic traditions. You have to remember where the rabbis are coming up with this. You know, that Haman had a idol. He was wearing an idol. And then, so he didn't want to bow down to that. There's another tradition that Mordechai and Haman already go back a long time. Because what do we know about Mordechai? You know, that tells us a little bit about Mordechai. How old is Mordechai? How old do you think Mordecai is? The simple reading. We don't know 100%, but the simple reading, how old is Mordecai at the time of the Megillah? Want to guess? 35 years old and starting his career, and he's got, like, you know, potential. Must be in his 50s. So let's go back to verse 5, chapter 2, verse 5. Ishu diya yabushushan habira. I noticed there's a pause there. They're going to have, the king announces we're going to have a beauty pageant. Ishu diya yabushushan habira. Shmur Mordechai ben yir ben shimi ben kishi shimini. Asher haglam yushalayim. Right, he was exiled from Jerusalem. So when was the exile of Jerusalem take place? What year?
586.
So 586 is the destruction of the temple. But most Jews were exiled actually 11 years earlier. The last remaining Jews in 586, but most of the Jews are actually exiled in 597. No, let's take 586. When is the Megillah thing? We'll do this reading, assuming it took place then. So we're talking 50, 60 years later. Now, it could be that Mordechai was a little kid when he was exiled, but it's not the feeling yet. I mean, yet Mordechai was already sort of an established person, and he's somebody who remembered, who lived during the first temple period, and here he is. He's already an older man. Most likely he's an older man, which also might explain why he doesn't bow down to Haman. He's like the senior citizen here. I'm going to bow down to this, you know. I don't know how old Haman is, but he might be a young guy. Anyways, but again, I just want to point out, it's not at all clear that he shouldn't bow down to Haman. That's maybe he was wrong.
Haman has 10 sons, so mathematically, he's probably not that much younger than Mordecai.
Right. I don't know if it's all from one wife, though. The Bible, people have more than one wife, but even so he's married for 15 years, 20 years. His wife had a kid every 2 years. Got married at 25. Okay, his kids are older. Right, okay, yeah. Right. So that's what I was alluding to before. There are opinions that Haman and Mordechai knew each other already from 50 years back, and that Haman owed a debt to Mordechai, and again, this is not in the Megillah at all, but I think the rabbis are trying to create sort of some type of a relationship. In other words, Mordechai and Haman are not the first time they're meeting. And for whatever reason, Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman. He's going against the wishes of the king. That's not a smart thing to do. That's not a smart thing to do. And the rabbis, they call him out on that. At least, you know, some of them, yes.
But Esther was the daughter of his uncle. So wouldn't they be the same?
Esther was his first cousin. Right, I think that's the star. No, I hold on. No. I always get confused. I have to read this carefully. No, who was? What does it say? Let's go back here. He Esther bat dodo. She's Esther, the daughter of his uncle. Ki ein la ava ein. Vanarei fato right. That's the right. He Esther bat dodo. Okay, so they're first cousins. So you're telling me they're first cousins. So she's, and Esther's probably pretty young, right? The impression in the Megillah is Esther's young. So I don't know that you have to interpret bat dod. It can be a great, you know, it has to be literal. But first cousins can be many years apart. First cousins can be 30, 40 years apart. That's not, even if they are first cousins, whatever, for sure, 20 years apart, that's... happens all the time. I don't know. How is there? Esther's presumably young. I don't know, yes. Okay, now. So Haman gets very upset, and he throws a lottery we mentioned last week on the 13th of Nisan, which of course is Erev Pesach, right? Erev Pesach. Now, what's the connection between Pesach and Purim? The main part of the story takes place over Pesach. We alluded to this last week. The three-day fast presumably takes place instead of the Seder. There is no Seder that year. It happened very soon. There was immediately Mordecai goes to the street. Esther goes out, calls a three-day fast. So whether that's the 13th, by the 16th of Nisan, 15th, 16th of Nisan, they're already fasting, right? So they basically canceled Pesach that year.
Can we do that this year?
The Gemara said to do it on we should cancel Tisha B'Av instead. Pesach is okay, but let's cancel Tisha B'Av. The Gemara says that when Tisha B'Av is on a Sunday, meaning when the ninth of Av is on a Shabbat, which it is this upcoming year, and then you have to fast on the 10th of Av instead. So Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, the author of the Mishnah, says, you know what? We miss Tisha B'Av. Once we pushed off Tisha B'Av, we don't have to fast. We don't like to do negative things. That's why we all read Megillat Esther from a cloth, from parchment. The custom is Megillat Eicha. We never read from a parchment, Eicha, the lamentation, because we don't want that as a permanent book. We throw it away. There's got to be every way you throw away. We don't have Tisha B'Av next year. So Rebbe actually, in the Gemara, says that when we don't observe Tisha B'Av, we don't follow Rebbe's view. And I don't even think it's a bad, as much as I hate Tisha B'Av, is it this, at worst, the second most meaningful day of the year, I find. Maybe it's the most meaningful day of the year, because Yom Kippur, you're too busy doubling Tisha B'Av. If you do Tisha B'Av properly, it's a hard day. We do a full day learning. It's a hard day. It's a sad day, but it's a very important day. But they did, and that was a discussion, according to the Medrash, between Mordechai and Esther. What do you mean? We can't fast now. It's Pesach. And I said, well, if you don't fast now, maybe there'll be no more Pesachs of the Jewish people. But I mentioned this year we, of course, have two Adars to balance the calendar. So why do we celebrate Purim in the second Adar? I don't know if I mentioned this last week or not. Why do we observe Purim? Why not observe Purim? This comes up all the time. People have Yortzeit. So every day they know, should they do Yortzeit in the first Adar or the second Adar? And there are different customs, and sometimes different people do different things. But the simple meaning is the Yortzeit should always be in the first Adar, unless there were two Adars when the person died, and the person died in the second Adar. But why? Because the first Adar is the real Adar. What's the second Adar? The second Adar is the add-on month. In other words, we need to balance the solar and lunar year. And very often, they would only decide after Purim. They would wait till the last minute to make a decision. Now we have a fixed calendar. But before the 4th century of the Common Era, when we didn't have a fixed calendar, we didn't have a 7 and 9-year cycle. Every year, they'd make a decision, the last week of Adar, whether we're going to add a leap year or not. So the Mishnah says, if you read the Megillah on the 1st of Adar, and then they make a leap year, so you have to reread the Megillah again. You have to reread the Megillah. It comes to 14th of Adar. You don't know if there's going to be a leap year this year. Okay. So you have to observe Purim. And then it turns out a week later, they decide to make a second Adar. So a month later, you have to read the Megillah again. That's what the Mishnah says. You have to read the Megillah again. So the Gemara wants to know why. Why do we celebrate? Whenever there's a mitzvah, you should do it the first possible opportunity. Tisha B'Av, we push off. It's interesting. Tisha B'Av on Shabbos, we fast on Sunday. Tiny Esther on Shabbos, when do we fast? On Thursday. Because Tiny Esther is not a fast day of mourning. Mourning we push off, Tisha B'Av we push off, right? But Tiny Esther is like a joyful, I know it's a funny term to use, but it's not a day to do a normal fasting with the special prayers. And it's a different type of fast day, so we can do it earlier, right? But we always do a mitzvah earlier. So why is Purim celebrated in the second Adar? So the Gemara says, because we want to have Purim next to Pesach. So the Gemara says, want the Geula, the redemption of Purim, the Geula, and the Pesach next to each other. Why? So what's the difference between Purim and Pesach? Purim and Pesach, of course, are opposites, right? Pesach, who's the hero of Pesach? God. What's the role of Moshe at the Seder? It's not true. It's not historically true. But the way the rabbis want us to observe Pesach, what's the role of Moshe? Non-existent. Non-existent. It's a falsification of history. What do you mean? We have a Haggadah and we do not mention Moshe's name in the whole Haggadah. And I would say it's like telling the story of American independence without George Washington, right? It's like they just ignored Moshe. But that's done on purpose, because the purpose of Pesach is to establish, both for the non-Jews, for the Egyptians, and for the Jews for all time, that there's a God in this world, and there's a God who's a God of history. So we totally downplay the role of man. And Pesach is all about God. Purim, of course, is the exact opposite. wherein we totally downplay the role of God. We pretend there's no God in the Megillah, and God's name isn't mentioned. That was our first class, right? The Purim is all about how we observe without God, but they're really two flip sides. They're flip sides of the same coin. In other words, these two go together. There's the revealed God, or you want to say, my daughter just got a letter. Please God, she'll be going in seminary in Israel. So the person just wrote a letter about the Nesh Nikla, Nesh Nistar, the revealed miracle, you know, living in Israel, revealed miracles and hidden miracles. You know, they go together in a sense. So Purim and Pesach, the rabbis, it's true, Purim is very different, but they want the Purim next to Pesach. We don't want to separate. It's an interesting thing. It could be also the story of Purim took place on Pesach. That's also not a coincidence. In other words, whether God is manifest or not, God is manifest. In other words, that's the message the Megillah is trying to give to us. Anyway, so that's...
Is another thing the fact that they put in the special parshas, the special readings, the four parshas,
right,
on Purim?
Right.
It would make no sense to have it a month earlier if a Chodesh and Mishpat.
Well, then we could wait. We could wait. I mean, we do Shkalim. Really, Shkalim should be done before Nisan. Mm-hmm. We do Shkalim this week. We did Shkalim because the Gemara says the partial Shkalim is that everybody had to pay a half shekel. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to that in 1 second here in the Megillah, the use of Shkalim. Mm-hmm. But everybody had to pay a half shekel for the upkeep of the temple. A sort of basically shul membership. Everybody had to pay the same. It wasn't a lot of money, but if every single person pays it, you got a lot of money. So that shekel, the new shekel, was used on the 1st of Nisan, because Nisan is the beginning of the year. So they wanted to give people 30 days notice. So it's not, so if you had, in other words, it's the same thing. You just read it 30 days before. And if that would be the case, in other words, if you had Purim in the first month, so you'd read Parshat Zachor before Parshat Shkalim.
What about a Chodesh? Well, that's when you
it's also before Pesach. Right, they're both before Pesach.
Right.
HaChodesh says right before Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Right. And Parshat Shkalim, which takes effect on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, we read before Rosh Chodesh Adar. We want to give a month in advance notice. But that's... And by the way, when they read those Parshat, they didn't read Parshat HaShavua. You realize that. In other words, whenever you read a special Parshat, you didn't read the regular Parshat of the week. Those were the parshas. They remember when they used to read the Chumash, I think it's a Mishnah Institute. They used to read the Chumash in two languages until the 13th century. They would read the first five words. People didn't have a Hertz Chumash or Art Scroll or whatever on the new Chumash. I always say that. The Hertz Chumash, the end of the Hertz Chumash, nobody uses the Hertz Chumash anymore, right? Everybody in this room used the Hertz Chumash as a kid? Every single person, I'm sure. And nobody uses it anymore, correct? Anybody ever use the Hertz Chumash? No.
Sure.
No. Yeah, you still use the Hertz Chumash? What schools have Hertz Chumash anymore?
At home.
But nobody has Hertz Chumash because Hertz Chumash represented an era in Jewish life where Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform schools could all use one Chumash. And today, the Orthodox use Art Scroll and the Conservative use Eitz Chaim. And the Reform used the Rabbi Plaut Chumash. The words are, as far as I know, the words are the same in all three. But the stuff on the bottom is up. But there was a time Hertz, somehow, who was a graduate of Jewish Theological Seminary, in the days when the differences between JTS and Yeshiva University were hard to tell, or were minimal, or for sure they can maybe they are a little bit more, but for sure conservative and Orthodox shuls, often it was very hard to tell. You couldn't tell. And whatever, he appealed. Anyways, that was a different era. But they used to read the Chumash in Hebrew, and they used to have a translator, because most people didn't know Hebrew. There's nothing new. So they would read it in Aramaic, or whatever language, and they would read it first five verses out loud. So that Torah reading took longer. It was more, was a real learning thing. Today, we don't do that anymore. Anyway, okay. So what is... What does Haman say? How does Haman get Ahasuerus to agree to kill the Jewish people? How does Paro decide to wipe out the Jewish people?
By eliminating all the sons.
Yeah, you think he woke up one day and said, we're going to eliminate all the sons. So, you always have to set the ground. Even Hitler, Yimach Shmo, didn't start with the final solution. The historians think he may not even have that in mind. when he started, he didn't think to wipe out every Jew, not to get rid of the Jews from Germany, whatever. But when the world didn't do anything, you know, you keep going step by step. What do you have to do? You have to lay the groundwork for to before you exterminate peoples all over. So you start. It starts with words, of course. That's right. Yeah, you have to. Yeah, it always starts with words. So there. But the same thing by Paro. He didn't. They didn't wake up. First of all, you had to wait till you had the king who didn't know who Joseph was, whatever that means. And then he started with taxes, and they said, you're going to build cities, you're going to do this. And then one by one, and then, you know, slowly by slowly, you build up, and then we can kill all the boys. With Ahasuerus, it's pretty quick. I mean, that's the one day. Haman, by the way, there's the Jews have never been mentioned in the Megillah. Mordechai is Jewish. Jews haven't done anything wrong. And one day, Haman goes to Mordechai and said, yeah, I want you to know there's a people here. Yeshno am achad mefuzar mefuad bein amim. V'tateihem shonot micholam, v'tateihem melachinam shavim. Their religion is different. They're everywhere you go. They're mefuzar mefuad bein amim. They're all over the place. They are divided. They have their own laws. It doesn't pay to keep them alive. What do you mean or to leave them? What do you mean it doesn't pay? Is this like economics or like... it sounds like, because what does he say? He says, you know what? If you let me get rid of the Jews, I'll give you 10,000 kikar kesef. It's in like $8 trillion. Like it's some enormous sum of money. If you do the calculation, what a kikar and adanim that we're reading about now, it's like, it's an exaggeration of the Megillah, most likely. I'll give for you. So it does sound a little bit an economics, like you'll make a lot of money. You get rid of the Jews, it's always the opposite, right? Whenever Jews were kicked out of a country, the country usually lost their economic status. Like in Spain, you know, Jews are always, that's how Jews managed to survive in the Middle Ages. The Jews were always the people who financially were very important to the kingdom. I mean, even when the Jews were kicked out of Spain, the Abarbanel was offered the opportunity to stay. So what is, Ahasuerus, and that's, you know, Ahasuerus agrees right away. Does he know? By the way, does Haman ever say he's going to kill them? You could argue he does. Yikatev le'abdam. Right. Imal ha-melech tov. V'aser lefim kikar kesef o'shei o'shei melech. So why does later on when Esther says that somebody wants to kill us, so Ahasuerus says, mi huzeh ve'zehu? Who's this person? When is he wants to kill the Jews? That's crazy. And it says, Haman, that's the one who wants to do it. But he doesn't know? He was lying? All right, just keep that question. In other words, later on in the story, Ahasuerus, he plays dumb, which is maybe like, you know, it's a good move for, you know, if the prime minister wants to get the attorney general to do something, you don't do it yourself. You call up your assistants in the PMO office, and you tell them he made the mistake that he was at the meeting too. But usually you don't do it because you always need to claim deniability. The leader always has to have somebody in between him to claim, I didn't know, well, what do you want from me? That's exactly what Paro did, the Ramban. He asked the midwives to kill all the people. What do you want from me? I'm not involved in this. I mean, of course, they give the order, but they try to remove themselves from the order. So I don't know, Ahasuerus, he did know, and he's pretending he didn't know. Some say he really didn't know. Maybe he didn't know at all. He didn't know what Haman was doing. Haman came to him. He was half drunk one day, Ahasuerus, and he said, you know, there's, okay, whatever you're going to, he didn't listen. You're going to give me, it's going to be, the economy's going to grow, and I'm going to get reelected. Remember, we spoke last week. Ahasuerus is very into being liked by the people. That's why he makes parties. And that's why he lowers the taxes when Esther's in, because he's a weak king. So he has to get the people to like him. He doesn't have that self-confidence. So Haman says, you do this, you'll make a lot of money. It's good for the... Oh, okay. So he doesn't even care about all the details. So maybe he really didn't know. But it's very interesting. Now, what's Haman... Is Haman's argument... Is it true? In other words, is Haman's argument true? That the Jewish people are mifuraz u'mifurad bein amim, v'dat ta'ehem shonot mikolam. What's Haman saying about the Jews? Dual loyalty. No? Isn't that what he's saying? Jews have dual loyalty. They're different. You can't really trust them. They do all these weird things, right? Now, what does mifurazu mifuzaru mifurad ben hamim mean?
Scattered among all the nations.
That means what?
But integrated.
They're integrated or not? They're integrated.
I think they're integrated. Yeah.
What does Bilam say? When he questions the Jewish people, Matovo Alecha Yaakov, right? That's the more famous thing Bilam says. But Heim Am Levadat Yishko, Yishuvagayim Lo Yitchashev. They stay apart. They don't get involved with the Heimam Levadat Yishkon. The Jews are separate from everybody else. So Bagayim Lo Yitchashev. So of course, this you can say it's what we always say about anti-Semitism. This anti-Semite thinks the Jews are too separate, and this anti-Semite thinks the Jews are too integrated. Whatever you do, it's no good. But now, how do the rabbis understand this verse? Again, it's not this what the simple reading of the Megillah. But remember, if the rabbis are putting this in Tanakh, the rabbis see this as a religious book, even though the book itself has no, can be read totally as a secular book, and the parting, everything. But obviously the rabbis are reading it as a religious text, and that's why they're putting it in the Bible. So how do the rabbis interpret this verse? I'm sorry? So what does yeshno mean? There is, so the rabbis read yeshno. Remember, there are no vowels always in Hebrew, right? What's yeshno mean? Yashnu. The Jewish people were sleeping. No. Yashnu. Amachad. Mifuzar mufra. The Jewish people are divided. That's always the Achilles heel of the Jewish people. We don't get along. We're fighting with each other. Mifurad mufrad ben amim. Vedatehem, in plural, their religions. Every Jew has their own religion, right? We're very divided into, subgroups. I mentioned last week, 46 parties running. So, two Arab parties running, I think. So 44 Jewish parties running in the elections in Israel. So the rabbi saw this as a critique of the Jewish people. That the Jewish, now mentioned, maybe they participated in the eating at the Suda, at the party of Ahasuerus, maybe they go back to Israel. We don't know what, because the Jewish people are hidden. The Jewish people aren't doing anything. But it's very interesting how they read it. Now, on the other hand, what does Haman do? He takes 10,000 talents of silver, right? So the Medrash has a beautiful comment. It says, Haman, you think you're going to get to the Jews by the Shkalim? Uh-uh. The Jewish people beat you to it. Where the Jewish people beat you to it? Well, we read this past Shabbos, the Machatzit HaShekel. The Jewish people give the shekel to build the temple. That shekel is going to defeat your shekel. And what kind of an argument is that? Well, what do the rabbis mean to say? Haman, I'm sure, never heard of the Machatzit HaShekel, even though from this, I would imagine. What are the rabbis saying? So if you're going to tell me the Jewish people are divided and are fighting, that they have, and so what's the Machatzit HaShekel, of course, represent? Is the unity of the Jewish people on two levels. First of all, the famous idea, why does everybody give half a shekel? That was what they had to give. Everybody had to give. Why half a shekel? Because what does half mean? Half means you're incomplete. Half means you can't do it on your own. Nobody, you can't build a Jewish community. You can't build anything on your own. Every Jew can only participate half. So you have to have machatzit hashekel. And of course, it's used for the temple. The temple was always the symbol of Jewish unity. It was not only a symbol of Jewish unity, it's a symbol of world unity, of world peace. I mean, the time of world peace when Shlomo HaMelech was the king, that's when it was the best time of world peace. And that's why we bring 70 bulls on Sukkot to represent the 70 nations of the world. So so in a sense, the response to Mordechai, or to Haman, is really the Machatzit HaShekel represents our response to the Shkalim that they want to do. You have the same idea. This is also in the Chama Leibowitz idea. I heard from the Chama Leibowitz. Vayakam Bilam Baboker. Bilam woke up in the morning, and what did he do? He saddled his donkey to go curse the Jewish people. So Rashi quotes Amedrash as, Bilam, you idiot. You want to think, you think you're going to get up early and curse the Jewish people? Avram Avinu beat you to it. Because it says, Avram Vayashkem Avraham Aboker. Avram got up early in the morning And he saddled his donkey to do what? To take Yitzchak, for Kedet Yitzchak. So look at the dedication of the Jewish people. So he beat you by 400 years. So you know, you're not going to be able to defeat him by getting up early. That's, you know, normally he did it himself. You know, his hatred was so great, he saddled his own donkey. Abraham's willingness to carry out the will of God, whatever, was so great, he saddled his own donkey. But of course, he beat you to it. He beat you to it because he lived 400 years earlier. So Nechama Leibovitz had a beautiful idea. She said that if you look at the wording, by Bilam it says Vayakam, Bilam Baboker. By Abraham it says Vayashkem, Abraham Baboker. What's the difference between Vayakam and Vayashkem? Vayakam means he woke up. When he woke up, he said, whenever he got up. What's Vayashkem? Vayashkem, he got up early. In other words, he set up his alarm clock for 4 o'clock in the morning. Vayashkem is earlier. In other words, it's the dedication of the Jewish people was greater than the dedication of Bilam, which is, of course, the opposite. Because usually, you follow? No, that makes sense, or you don't like that?
You've talked about so many things that I knew nothing about. You're opening my eyes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm not sure. Okay, I'll have to, okay.
It's all good.
Tell me. Sometimes, because I, especially here, because I'm trying to cover a lot of ground, so sometimes, you know, I go, but tell me. But I'll try to review. But, what are the rabbis saying here? The rabbis are saying the power for good can defeat the power for evil. Now, we know that the power for evil is greater. People, when they're angry, they'll do anything to get back. I want to help you. It's snowing today. I'm going to go to class. It's rainy and icy and 20 below zero. Forget it. But if you want to hurt somebody, you don't care that it's 20 below zero. That's why the power for evil. We spoke last week about the descendants of Haman learning Torah in Bnei Brak. Because he said, the greater the evil, the greater the power. From evil can come good. And from evil can come greater good than sometimes can come from good itself. And that's what he said, a Baal Tshuva, a person who sinned and then repents, is on a higher level. Because that power, that energy to do wrong, gets transferred to do good. To do good, yeah, I'll do good. But when a person did bad and he takes that energy, he's going to do way more good. So that's really what the Megillah is saying, that we have the power to defeat the evil plots. It's not that Abraham lived before Bilam, and that we did the Machatzit HaShekel before the Shkalim of Haman. It's what the Machatzit HaShekel represents, the coming together of Jewish people. When the Jewish people come together, nobody can defeat us. That's by the Machatzit. And the same thing by Abraham, that his desire to do was greater than Bilam's desire, which is not the way, you know, we normally think. Okay. All right, so then, so that's how Achashverosh agrees. Now, one other important point, I guess I should say, and this ties back into the first chapter, but we have it here. Achashverosh tells Haman, you can write a letter, right? Write a letter to let everybody know. Now, it's very interesting, and it's very strange. To write a letter. Now, what happens when Achashverosh, when he finds out that Mordechai saved his life, and he finds out that Haman wants to kill the Jews? How can Haman kill the people who saved my life? And he says, okay, we're going to kill Haman, and the whole story now goes in reverse, you know. The tree that he built for Mordechai gets used for him, right? So, what should Achashverosh do? He should what? Rescind the order, right? You gave an order to kill the Jew. What does he do?
He doesn't
do that. Why not? What did he do? He said, you know what, you can send another letters. Now, again, this is, you can say, a conniving king. We discussed a brilliant conniving king. What did he just set up, the king? He set up a war between the factions. And his government, he should have rescinded authority, you can't kill Jews anymore. Now, why did he say he can't do that? So forget the Machiavellian, approach that he wanted, the people fighting against each other. Why couldn't he just rescind the order? Because Ktav HaNiktav B'Tabar HaMelech Ein Lashiv. When the king writes something, it's final. And that's the first letters that he wrote about on Vashti. When the king writes something, right? And how does the Megillah say he gathered together his Yodei Dat V'Din, people who knew anything? The difference, okay, in the Megillahs and Achashverosh's like kingdom, things are fixed. Nothing can change. It's like, who did he call upon? Yodei Dat V'Din. Who are their Yodei Dat V'Din? Like the astrologers, you know, everything is fated. There's a fate that can't be undone. You can add something new, but you can never undo it. The Jewish people, of course, live the exact opposite. We live sort of in uncertainty. And what does Mordechai say to Esther? She doesn't want to go into Achashverosh, right? What is it's such a beautiful thing. This is now verse 4. Chapter 4. Chapter 4, he says, verse 12. Vayomer Mordechai la'ashiv el Esther. You know, Esther's upset. He's dressed like a hobo on the street. Give him clothes. Come back to that. Al tadami bin avshech. Don't think you can hide in the king's court. You know, you're a Jew in the king's court. Don't hide your Judaism. It's a big political issue, right? How Jewish should a Jew be? Like, you know, you'd be like a Joe Lieberman, you know, or you'd be like a Bernie Sanders, you know, and they have to bring it out of you that you're Jewish, right? Sometimes it's no good because if the Jews too pro-Israel, they say, because these Jews, right? It's not so simple. But so, right, Al tadam ibn avshech, do not hide in the king's court, mikol yudim. Kim acharesh tacharishi boedahi. Because if you're silent at this time, revach vatsala yamod leyudim imakom acher. The Jewish people are going to be saved. You realize that's a contradiction. Mordechai just contradicted himself. He says, you're the queen. The Jewish people are in trouble. You're the only person who has access to Achashverosh. You better go in Achashverosh and save the Jewish people. Otherwise, we're dead. So Esther, it's all on you. But you know what? If you don't do it, that's okay. God will find this salvation from somewhere else. He totally contradicts himself. I don't know if you've ever picked up on that, right? He tells her, go to the king, right? Do not think you can save yourself. The Jewish people are in trouble. You better go. And if you're quiet, don't worry. We'll be saved anyways. You'll be lost. And who knows if this is why you were appointed the queen? In other words, I don't know. It's uncertainty. Everything is hidden. Everything is hidden in the Megillah. Esther, Achashverosh goes to Yodei Dat V'Din. Achashverosh, we know everything. We're going to have a meeting. We know what's going to be. And what does Mordechai say? We don't know what's going to be tomorrow. Mi Yodea, maybe this is why you became the queen, to save the Jewish people. Maybe not. Who knows? But it's not just Mordechai telling Esther. It's the language, mi yodei and yodei dat v'din, it's a complete reversal of the way the Persians' world was working. And Esther's got to do the exact opposite. But it's a beautiful thing that I once heard somebody said, a fundraiser went over to somebody, said, we're doing a big project. We need your money. We're going to get your money. And I want you to know that if you don't give us your money, we're going to build it anyways without you, and you won't get any. So, like, does that make somebody want to give or not want to give? Like, in other words, we need your money, but you know, you don't give your money, I'll do it without you. You know, I don't need you. But it's sort of, so that's the way of the Jewish people. And then it says, how is this going to have lech knoset kol yudim? That's the answer. Haman says, you're mifuzar or mifurad. And Esther says, lech knos, gather, like a beit knesset. Hanim Tsaim Beshushan, by the way, which is the same language of the original party, that Achashverosh made a party, L'chola Am Hanim Tsaim Beshushan. And now Esther's using Hanim Tsaim Beshushan to fast. Now, how long did they fast for?
3 days.
3 days, yeah? Really? I mean, yeah, it's what it says. Really, it is what it says. Can you fast for 3 days? It says, so I would say, you know, people fast so they ate at night. You know, they ate in between. But it says, so I don't know. Maybe people were stronger back then. I just find it a little bit You don't have to take it literally, I don't think. 3 days just means like like three intense days of prayer. I don't know if that means they didn't eat and drink for 3 days, because that's, you can't live that way. Unless you can. It's not a critique. I think we know, especially in the Megillah, everything's an exaggeration in the Megillah. But anyways, okay. I'm sorry?
It says right after, it says either night or day.
Oh, in the English? Is that how they translate it? To what?
Neither.
No, you can't eat in, right, neither day or night you can eat.
In mine it says either night.
It says that.
It's
for the meaning.
Whether it's night or day, you can't eat or drink.
Right, you can't eat or drink. Whatever, that's just a side point. But you see, basically, Esther's taking everything and turning it upside down. Now, let's tie back to what I said a few minutes ago between Pesach and Purim, then we have to stop. What happens when the Jewish people come to the Yam Suf and they start complaining, right? So what does God say to Moshe? Mati tzak elai, don't cry out to me. Go forward. Now, what's the pasuk? Hashem yilechem lechem v'atem tach rishun. Right? Isn't that it? You should be silent. Atem tach rishun. You. A cheresh in Hebrew is a deaf mute. Al tekala cheresh. Lifnei iver. Don't put a stumbling block by a blind person, and don't curse a deaf person, even though he can't hear you. Al tekala cheresh. That's right. So it means to be silent. A cheresh. So by this, when we left Egypt, God says, "Atem tach harishun." You have to be silent. But in the Megillah, Mordechai says, "Im charesh tach harishi." If you're going to be silent, we can't be silent. So again, it's the total opposite, and that's why they're the same. In other words, that's why Purim is on Pesach. It's just two sides of the flip coin, two, whatever the expression is, flip sides of the same coin. Okay, it's 9:33, so I don't want to keep people elated, but just let's review a little bit. What did we learn? A test. We give it after 5 weeks. We give a test. Anybody passes, we give a okay. We get this beautiful book. We get this, but the precarious nature of the Jewish people. Haman gets picked instead of Mordechai. That's where he started. What's going on? Mordechai saves the life. The comparison to the Yosef story with Esther, Vayefkeda Melech Vayikbitzu, Kol Nara, Nara Abdullah, Biktan, the Teresh, Teresh, the wine, the Shnei Sarisei Hasaf, it's the story of Yosef. Over again, Achashverosh needs a security guard. Achashverosh is always very nervous, which, by the way, will come up, we'll discuss, please God, next week. That's Esther, how manipulates him at the parties, invites him to the various parties. Haman's argument of the Jewish people, why Achashverosh listens right away. Haman's argument, the disunity of the Jewish people are scattered all over the place, different religions, and of course the response of the Machatzit HaShekel, that our shekel is better, the power to do good, our fasting beats your parties. You notice fasting is a total opposite. Everything in the Megillah is about a party. But when the Jewish people are going to be saved, they have to go to fasting. That's the way the Jewish people in times of crisis react. And then really the main message is everybody has to do their part. We live in the period of Purim. Pesach was a one-time event. We don't live in Pesach. For the last 2,000 years, we've been living like Purim, 2,500 years. God is not around. Not manifest around. And so we have to act. We're not allowed. Atem tach harishun, that was in the time of the Seder. But now we have to act. And even if we don't act, the Jewish people will be okay. It's not, whatever, I guess. Well, I was always taught to be an optimist. Maybe being born in the post in the generation of the State of Israel after the Holocaust, it's easy to be an optimist. I don't know. But anyways, okay, so we'll stop here and please God continue next week. Where the Megillah turns. It turns now, we're going to come after 3 days, and that's when the switch of the Purim story takes place. Okay? Thank you. Laila Tov.